Part 3 Chapter 12 The dark curtains on the two windows in Alexei's little bedroom that looked onto the glassed-in veranda had been drawn. Yelena's head of golden hair shone in the dark room, mirrored by the pale, indistinct blur that was Alexei's head and neck on the pillow. A wire from the plug snaked towards the chair. The pinkish light in the lamp with its little shade went on, and day had turned into night. Alexei gestured to Yelena to close the door.
Warn Anyuta immediately. She mustn't say anything.
Yes, all right, I know. Alyosha, try not to talk too much.
Yes, I know. I'll talk quietly. Oh, if only I don't lose my arm.
Oh, Alyosha, lie still and be quiet. What about this woman's coat? Is it going to stay here for a bit?
Yes, yes, and on no account must Nikolka try to take it to her. Otherwise, out there, on the street. Do you hear? And in general, for goodness sake, don't let him go anywhere.
May God bring her health and happiness, Yelena said sincerely and tenderly. And they say there aren't any good people in this world.
A faint patch of color appeared on the sick man's cheekbones, and he glanced up at the low white ceiling. Then he turned to Yelena and asked with a grimace,
Ah, yes. And who, may I ask, is this dolt who's just appeared?
Yelena leant forward in the pink glow of the lamp and shrugged her shoulders.
Well, you see, he's someone who turned up literally only a couple of minutes before you did. He's Seryozha's nephew from Zhytomyr. You've heard the name Larion Suzhansky. Well, here he is, the famous Lariosik.
And?
He's come here with a letter. There's been some trouble back there. He had just begun to tell me about it when she brought you here.
And he has some bird or other with him, for heaven's sake.
Laughing, but with a look of horror on her face, Yelena leant down towards the bed.
Never mind about the bird. He's asking if he can live here, with us. I don't know what to do.
Live here?
Well, yes. But be quiet, and lie still, please, Alyosha. In her letter, his mother begs us to take him in. She adores this Lariosik of hers, you know. I've never seen such a clumsy fool as this Lariosik in my life. The first thing he does when he gets here is to smash all the crockery. The blue dinner service. There are only two plates left intact.
So, there we are. I don't know what to do anymore.
The whispering continued for a long time in the pink glow of the lamplight. Some distance away, on the other side of the door and the curtains, the voices of Nikolka and the unexpected guest could be heard. Yelena wrung her hands, begging Alexei not to talk quite so much. In the dining room there was the crunch of broken china as the agitated Anyuta swept up the blue dinner service. In view of the fact that nobody had any idea what might be going on in the city, and that therefore people would very possibly be coming to requisition rooms, and in view of the fact that they had no money, and that someone would be paying for Lariosik's keep, they decided to let him stay, but on condition that he observed the rules of the Turbin household. As far as the bird was concerned, they agreed to have it for a trial period. If it should prove impossible to have it in the house, then it would have to leave, although its owner could remain. As for the dinner service, it was decided it would be best to forget all about it. It would have been in such appallingly bad taste to complain, and Yelena naturally couldn't mention it. They decided to allow Lariosik to sleep in the library, where they would put a bed with a spring mattress and a little table. Yelena went into the dining room. Lariosik stood there sorrowfully, hanging his head and looking at the spot on the sideboard where the stack of 12 plates had been, an expression of absolute misery in his cloudy, light blue eyes. Nikolka stood opposite them, his mouth open. He was clearly listening to every word Lariosik was saying. His eyes were full of an unbridled curiosity.
There's no leather in Zhytomyr, gabbled Lariosik. None at all, you understand. At least not the kind of leather I'm used to. I've asked round all the shoemakers, offering them any amount of money, but no use.
Seeing Yelena come into the room, Lariosik turned pale and started moving shiftily, glancing down for some reason at the emerald hem on Yelena's dressing gown.
Yelena Vasilyevna, I will go down to the shops at once, ask around, and you will have a new dinner service today. I don't know what to say. How can I apologize to you? I deserve the death penalty for what I did. I'm such a hopeless case, he said, turning to Nikolka. I'll go down to the shops at once, he repeated to Yelena.
I would really rather you didn't go to the shops, particularly since they'll be closed anyway. Let me ask you, do you really not know what's going on in the city?
Of course I know what's going on, Larry Osick exclaimed. I arrived on the hospital train, if you remember, as you know from the telegram.
What telegram? Yelena asked. We haven't had any telegram.
What?
Larry Osick's mouth opened wide in astonishment.
Uh-huh. I can see now, he said, turning to Nikolka, why you're looking at me in such a puzzled way. But if you'll permit me, Mama certainly handed in a telegram with 63 words.
Phew, 63 words, Nikolka said, quite astonished at such news.
What a pity. But the telegraph service is working very poorly at the moment, you know. In fact, it's stopped altogether.
So what will happen now? Larry Osick asked dejectedly. Will I be able to stay with you?
He looked around the room helplessly, and it was immediately clear from his expression that he liked it at the Turbins very much, and that he had no wish to go anywhere else.
Everything's organized, answered Yelena with a friendly nod. We agree to have you here so you can stay and make yourself at home. But you can see what an unfortunate thing has happened to us.
Larry Osick became even more dejected, his eyes filled with tears.
Yelena Vasilyevna, he exclaimed emotionally, allow me to help you in any way you would like. I can do without sleep for 3 or 4 nights in a row if necessary, you know.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And now, Larry Osick said, turning to Nikolka again, might I trouble you for some scissors?
Agog with astonishment and curiosity, Nikolka flew off somewhere and returned with a pair of scissors. Blinking rapidly, Larry Osick grabbed his army jacket by one of its buttons and once again turned to Nikolka.
Forgive me, do you think I could use your room for a moment?
Once he was in Nikolka's room, he took off his jacket, revealing an exceptionally dirty shirt underneath. With the scissors, he made a cut in the lustrous black lining of his jacket and pulled out a thick yellow and green wad of money. Solemnly, he carried the money into the dining room and put it down on the table in front of Yelena.
Yelena Vasilyevna, he said, I am pleased, with your permission, to be able to give you the money for my keep now.
But why such a hurry? Yelena said, blushing. Perhaps we can wait a little.
No, no, Yelena Vasilyevna, Larry Osick protested hotly. Please accept the money from me now. I know full well just how important it is to have money at this time.
As he was unwrapping the bundle, the photograph of a woman fell out onto the table. He picked it up hastily and put it in his pocket with a sigh.
Anyway, you'll be able to make better use of it. What will I need apart from being able to buy some cigarettes for myself and canary seed for the bird?
For a moment, Yelena forgot about Alexei's wound, and her eyes sparkled with pleasure. Larry Osick's actions were so appropriate and thorough.
It seems he's not such a dolt as I had first imagined, Yelena thought. He's polite and conscientious, just a little eccentric. But I am devastated about the dinner service.
What a character, Nikolka said to himself. The fact of Larry Osick's quite miraculous appearance among them had totally driven any unhappy thoughts from his mind.
There's 8,000 here, Larry Osick said, pushing the bundle of money resembling fried eggs with onions across the table. If it's not enough, we can do some recalculating and I can get some more.
No, no, that's perfect. We can talk about that later, said Yelena. This is what I suggest you do now. I'll ask Anyuta to heat up the water and you can have a bath. But tell me, I still don't quite understand how you managed to get here.
Yelena gathered up the money and put it into her enormous dressing gown pocket. Larry Osick's eyes filled with horror as the memories flooded back.
It was a nightmare, he exclaimed, folding his arms across his chest like a Catholic at prayer. I was on the train for 9 days. No, sorry, was it 10? Let me see, Sunday, yes, Monday. I was on the train from Zhytomyr for 11 days.
11 days, Nikolka shouted. You see, he said to Yelena reproachfully.
Yes, 11 days. When we set out, the Hetman's troops were in charge of the train, but along the way, Petliura's men took it over. When we came to some station or other, let me think, what was its name? Oh, never mind, it doesn't matter. They wanted to take me off the train and shoot me. Can you imagine? Petliura's men had those fur caps with tassels.
Were they blue? Asked Nikolka, burning with curiosity.
No, red. Yes, they were red. Anyway, they started shouting at me, telling me to get off the train. We're going to shoot you immediately, they said. They had decided that I must be an officer who had been hiding in the hospital train. But I'd only been able to get on the train because Mama knew Dr. Koritsky.
Koritsky? Nikolka exclaimed knowingly. Ah, yes, him. Cat and Kit.
We know him.
Kitty, cot, kit, cot,
trilled the little bird distantly from the other room.
Yes, him. He'd been the one to bring the train to us in Zhytomyr. Anyway, my God, thinking that everything was lost, I began to pray to God. And do you know what saved me? It was the bird. I told them that I wasn't an officer, but a professional bird breeder, and showed them my canary. At this, one of them gave me a wallop on the back of my head and said rudely, "Get the hell out of here, birdman!" The insolent swine. As a gentleman, I would have killed him, but you yourselves can understand.
Yelena!
Turbin could be heard feebly calling from his bedroom. Yelena quickly got up and rushed off, without hearing the end of the story. According to the calendar, on the 15th of December, the sun sets at 3:30. Twilight, therefore, began to seep into the apartment from 3 o'clock. But at this hour, the hands of the clock on Yelena's face pointed to 5:30, the most depressing and hopeless time of all. The hands were formed by the two sad folds at the corners of her mouth, stretching down to underneath her chin. Her eyes reflected her dejection and her determination to fight the disaster that now confronted them. The clock hands on Nikolka's face pointed to a spiky, ridiculous 20-1. His head was full of a sense of chaos and confusion, deriving from the expressive, enigmatic words, Maloprovalnaya Street, that had been uttered by a dying man on those war-torn crossroads the day before. Words whose significance would need to be made clear as soon as possible in the very near future. The chaos and worry had been further increased by the totally unexpected arrival of the enigmatic and engrossing figure of Lariosik into their lives, together with the most monstrous, far-reaching circumstance of all, the capture of the city by Petliura. Yes, Petliura, that Petliura, and yes, the city, our city. And what would happen there now was beyond the comprehension and grasp of even the most developed and educated minds. What was completely clear was, firstly, that a totally appalling catastrophe had taken place. All our troops had been taken unawares and slaughtered, their blood crying out in agony to the heavens. And secondly, those criminals at headquarters, the generals and staff officers, deserved nothing less than death. But apart from the horror of the situation, there was also a burning curiosity to find out what would actually happen. What would life be like for the 700,000 people living in the city who now found themselves in the hands of this mysterious person with such a fearsome and unattractive name, Petliura? What sort of a person was he, and why was he who he was? Yes, but even this had to take a back seat when compared with the most important point of all, the bloodiest and most terrible thing that had happened to Alexei. Oh my God. Just horrible, I tell you. And although it is true there had been no firm news, Myshlaevsky and Karas had most probably been killed as well. Nikolka was sitting at the slippery and greasy kitchen table, breaking up blocks of ice into little pieces with a broad-bladed chopper. The ice blocks were either splitting apart easily with a crunch as they did so, or they were skidding out from under the chopper and flying all over the kitchen. Nikolka's fingers had become numb from cold. The bag of ice with its silvery top lay close to hand.
Maloprovalnaya,
Nikolka said to himself, his lips moving soundlessly. Images of Nye Tours, the ginger-headed Nero, and Myshlaevsky flashed through his mind. And no sooner had this last image, of Myshlaevsky in his torn overcoat, come to mind, than the clock hands on the face of Anyuta, who was busy at the hot stove, her face expressing sad, confused dreams, began to show more and more clearly, 25 to 5, the time of depression and sorrow. Were those multicolored eyes still alive? Would anyone ever hear that broad stride, those jingling spurs again?
I need some ice, said Yelena, opening the door into the kitchen.
Just coming, Nikolka answered hastily. He screwed on the top of the ice bag and dashed through into the other room.
Anyuta, my love, said Yelena, you'll make sure you won't say a word to anyone about the fact that Alexei's been wounded, will you? If, God forbid, someone should find out which side he's been fighting on, we'll be in real trouble.
Of course I won't say anything, Yelena Vasilyevna. I completely understand.
Anyuta looked at Yelena, her eyes wide with anxiety.
Such terrible things going on in the city, Holy Mother of God. There I was on Borichevy Tok, just walking along, when I saw two bodies lying there on the street without boots. And the blood, there was so much blood. A crowd had gathered around, just standing and looking. Somebody was saying it was two officers who had been killed. They were just lying there, bareheaded. My legs gave way under me, and I nearly dropped my basket. Then I ran away.
Anyuta's shoulders shivered and twitched at the memory, and the frying pans slipped out of her hands, crashing onto the floor.
Shush, shush, for goodness sake,
Yelena said, calming Anyuta down with her outstretched hands. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the clock hands on Lariosik's grey face stood at precisely 12 o'clock, the time when energy and strength are at their peak. Both hands had converged on midday, fusing and pointing straight upwards like a sword. This was because after the disaster that had shattered Lariosik's tender heart in Zhytomyr, and after his terrible 11-day journey in the hospital train, and everything that he had had to live through, he was finding life in the Turbin household extraordinarily pleasant. Exactly why this should have been the case, Lariosik was unable to explain for the moment, because he didn't know the precise reason for it himself. The beautiful Yelena seemed to him to be particularly deserving of his respect and attention, and he liked Nikolka very much as well. Wishing to demonstrate this, Lariosik waited until Nikolka had stopped darting back and forth to Alexei's room. Then he helped him set up the narrow spring bed in the library.
You have a very open and trustworthy face, Lariosik said politely, looking so attentively at Nikolka's open face that he didn't watch what he was doing with the complicated creaking bed, and it slammed shut, trapping Nikolka's hand between two of the folds.
It was so painful that Nikolka let out a yell, which, although muffled, was sufficiently loud for Yelena to come rushing into the room. Large tears were involuntarily welling up in Nikolka's eyes, even though he was exerting every effort to stop himself from howling. Yelena and Lariosik grappled with the bed's complicated mechanism, eventually managing to release it and free Nikolka's numb blue hand. Lariosik almost burst into tears himself when he saw the crumpled, mottled hand emerge.
My God, he said, screwing up his already dejected face. What's the matter with me? I make such a mess of everything. Does it really hurt? Please forgive me, for God's sake.
Without saying anything, Nikolka ran into the kitchen, where Anyuta, as instructed, doused his hand with cold water from the tap. When they had succeeded in snapping open and unfolding the devious patent bed, and it had become clear that Nikolka's hand wasn't too badly damaged, Lariosik once again experienced an onrush of quiet pleasure at being somewhere where there were so many books. Apart from his love of birds, he had a passion for books. And here, on the open bookshelves, there were lines upon lines of one treasure after another. Along all four walls, Lariosik could see books of every description. In green, red, and gold bindings, yellow covers, and black slipcases. The bed had been made up some time ago. Next to it stood a chair with a towel hanging on the back, and with all the usual male accessories on the seat. Soap dish, cigarettes, matches, and watch. And, propped up against the back of the chair, there was a photograph of a mysterious woman. But Lariosik had eyes only for the library as he wandered around looking at the book-lined shelves, stopping every so often to squat down by the bottommost shelves and to feast his eyes on the covers, not knowing which to take out first. The posthumous papers of the Pickwick Club, or the 1871 issue of the Russian Herald. The hands on his face pointed to midday. But with the onset of twilight, the mood in the apartment became sadder and sadder. The clocks didn't once strike 12, their hands standing silent like gleaming swords wrapped in a flag of mourning. The cause of all this sadness, the reason for the different times showing on the clock faces of all those who were an inseparable part of the dusty, rather old-fashioned comfort of the Turbin household, was a slender column of mercury. At 3 o'clock in Alexei's bedroom, it had shown 39.6 degrees. Yelena turned pale when she saw it, and wanted to shake the thermometer down, but Alexei turned his head, and in a weak but insistent voice, asked her to show it to him. Silently and reluctantly, she handed him the thermometer. He looked at it and gave a deep, heavy sigh. By 5 o'clock, he was lying in his bed with a grey, cold bag on his head, the pieces of ice melting and floating around in the bag. There was now some colour in his cheeks, and his eyes were shining and much improved.
39.6. That's fine, he said, licking his dry, parched lips. So, anything might happen. In any event, that's the end of my practice for a bit. Just so long as I don't lose my arm. Otherwise...
Alyosha, do be quiet, please, said Yelena, tucking up the blanket round his shoulders.
Turbin fell silent and closed his eyes. From the wound high up in his left armpit, a dry, prickly heat had spread out and was crawling through his entire body. Every so often, he would breathe in deeply, holding his breath until his head swam, but his feet had become unpleasantly cold. By the evening, when all the lamps had been lit and dinner for the three of them, Yelena, Nikolka, and Lariosik, had long since passed in anxious silence, the column of mercury, miraculously swelling and rising from the dense silver bulb at the bottom of the thermometer, crept up to 40.2 degrees. And then, suddenly, in the pink glow of the bedroom, the despondency and anxiety began to dissipate and float away. This feeling of anxiety had come and squatted on the blanket in a great grey lump, but now it had turned into yellowish strands, drifting around like seaweed in water. Any worry about the practice and any fear for the future were now forgotten, eliminated by the seaweed. The sharp pain in the left side of his chest dulled and became less mobile. The fever was replaced by shivering. Now and then the burning candle in his chest changed into an icy knife that twisted somewhere in his lung. Whenever this happened, Alexei would shake his head, toss away the ice bag, and snuggle down deeper under the blanket. Then the pain in his chest would burst its boundaries, bringing on a spasm of such intensity that the wounded man would involuntarily start to moan in a weak, dry voice. And then, when the icy knife disappeared, giving way again to the hot candle, the heat flooded throughout his body, the sheet and the cramped space under the blanket. Then he would call out for water. Now Nikolka's, now Yelena's, and now Lariosik's face would appear out of the haze, bending down and listening. The eyes of all three seemed terribly alike, frowning and angry. The hands on Nikolka's face dropped immediately, pointing to 5:30 precisely, just like Yelena's. Every other minute, Nikolka would go out into the dining room, where, for some reason, the lights seemed to be burning especially dully and hesitantly, and look at the clock. Tonk, tonk, wheezed the clock angrily and ominously, its hands pointing to 9 o'clock, then to 9:15, and then to 5:30. Then Nikolka would sigh deeply, and wander off like a sleepy fly, out of the dining room, across the hallway, past Alexei's bedroom, and into the sitting room. From there he would go into the study, and pulling back the white curtains, look out through the balcony door onto the street.
Let's hope the doctor will find the courage to come.
The steep, winding street was emptier than it had been for many days, but things out there didn't look too awful. Now and then a cabbie's sleigh scraped along the snow, but only very occasionally. He started to consider whether perhaps he'd have to go himself, and whether he'd be able to persuade Yelena.
If he hasn't come by 10:30, I'll go myself, together with Larion Larionovich, while you stay here looking after Alyosha. No, please be quiet. You have the look of a cadet about you, don't you understand? And we can give Lariosik Alyosha's civilian clothes to wear.
Anyway, he'll be left alone if he's with a woman.
Lariosik hastily expressed his willingness to sacrifice himself and to go alone, and then he went off to get into civilian clothes. The icy knife had disappeared altogether, but the fever had intensified, exacerbated by the typhus. And in his fever, Alexei began to have vague visions of someone totally unknown, dressed in grey.
"Do you know that man in grey must have turned a somersault?" Alexei said suddenly, sternly and distinctly, looking directly at Yelena. "Not very pleasant. Basically, they're all birds, of course. They should be taken away and put in a warm larder, and they'd come to their senses there."
"What are you on about, Alyosha?"
asked Yelena, frightened, leaning over him and feeling the heat from his face on hers.
"Birds? What birds?"
In his black civilian clothes, Lariosik looked hunched and broader in the shoulders, with his yellow boots concealed under his trousers. Frightened, he looked around him disconsolately. Balancing on tiptoe, he ran out of the bedroom through the hallway into the dining room, and then through the library and on into Nikolka's room. Here, his arms swinging importantly, he went quickly up to the cage on the desk and threw a black cloth over the top of it. But there had been no need. The bird had long since been asleep in the corner, curled up into a feathery ball and quite silent, unaware of the world's troubles. Lariosik firmly closed the door into the library, and then the door from the library into the dining room.
"Not pleasant at all. Really nasty,"
Alexei said uneasily, looking into the corner of the room.
"I shouldn't have shot him.
No, listen."
He began to free his good arm from under the blanket.
"It would be best to ask him to come and explain why he was dashing about like that, like an idiot. I take full responsibility, of course. It's all so hopeless and stupid."
"Yes, of course it is," Nikolka said gravely, and Yelena hung her head.
Alexei became agitated and tried to get up, but the sharp pain was too strong, and he groaned.
"Then get rid of it," he said angrily.
"Perhaps we should take the bird into the kitchen. I've covered it up, by the way, and it's quiet,"
Lariosik whispered anxiously to Yelena. Yelena dismissed the idea with a wave of her hand.
"No, no, that's not it."
Nikolka strode out decisively into the dining room. His hair was disheveled. He looked at the clock. It was nearly 10. Anyuta appeared in the doorway.
"How is Alexei Vasilievich?" she asked anxiously.
"Delirious," Nikolka answered, sighing deeply.
"Oh, my goodness," Anyuta whispered. "Why doesn't that doctor come?"
Nikolka looked at her and went back into the bedroom. He bent down to Yelena's ear and began to whisper into it persuasively.
"It's your decision, but I would like to go and see if he's there. If he's not, then we need to get someone else. It's 10 o'clock, and it's quite quiet outside."
"Let's wait until 10:30,
Yelena whispered in reply, shaking her head and wrapping her hands in her shawl.
"It'll be difficult asking someone else. He'll come, I know he will."
Just after 10 o'clock, totally absurdly, a large, heavy mortar appeared in the narrow little bedroom. What the hell was that about? Staying here any longer would be senseless. The mortar took up so much space between the walls that its left wheel was pressed up against the bed. He couldn't stay here. He'd have to clamber out through the heavy spokes, then arch his back in order to squeeze through the other right-hand wheel with all his things, including God knows how much stuff, hanging on his left arm. The weight of everything would pull the arm down to the ground, so that it would cut into his armpit like a tow rope. The mortar couldn't be removed, so the whole apartment had become a mortar room, as ordered, and when that slow-witted Colonel Malyshev and Yelena, who had now also become slow-witted, saw the wheels, they wouldn't be able to do anything to get rid of the gun, or even to remove the patient to more tolerable conditions, to somewhere where there were no mortars. Because of that blasted, heavy, cold object, the apartment itself had become like a roadside inn. Then the doorbell started ringing. Ring, ring, and visitors began to appear. He caught a glimpse of Colonel Malyshev carrying a whole pile of papers, looking ridiculous, like some Laplander in his cap with earmuffs and his gold epaulettes. When Alexei called out to him, he disappeared down the barrel of the gun, only for Nikolka to come and start fussing about the place, incoherent and stupidly stubborn. Nikolka gave him something to drink, but instead of it being a cold stream of water from a fountain, it was something warm and disgusting, smelling as if it had come from a saucepan.
Ugh, that's revolting. Stop it, he mumbled.
Nikolka raised his eyebrows in alarm, but he persisted clumsily. Several times, Yelena changed into the dark and superfluous Lariosik, Seryozha's nephew. When she changed back again to being Yelena, she would run her fingers along his forehead, but without relieving the pain very much. Yelena's hands, usually so warm and deft, now felt like a rake as she scraped away idiotically, doing everything irritating and unnecessary to poison the life of a peaceful man lying stuck in this damned weapon store. But she couldn't be responsible for the pole on which his wounded body had been placed, could she? Yet what was the matter with her? She was sitting on the end of the pole, which was beginning to revolve nauseatingly under her weight. Well, you try and live when a round pole is digging into your body. No, no, it's all so unbearable. And, as loudly as he could, although it actually came out quietly, he called out,
Yulia!
But Yulia didn't respond to the sick man's call, remaining in her old-fashioned room with the portrait of a man of the 1840s with gold epaulettes. And the grey figures, who, together with the other Turbins, began parading round the apartment and the bedroom, would have been the final straw for the wounded man, had it not been for the arrival of a large man, a persistent and very capable man, in gold-rimmed glasses. In honour of his appearance, one more light was added to the room in the form of a flickering wax candle in an old black heavy candlestick. The candle now glimmered on the table, now moved around Alexei, while the ugly figure of Lariosik flitted around the walls above, looking like a bat with clipped wings. The candle leant over sideways, dripping white wax. The little bedroom smelt strongly of iodine, spirit, and ether. A chaotic jumble of glittering little boxes with lights in nickel-plated mirrors started to mount up on the table, together with piles of cotton wool. Theatrical Christmas snow. The large man in the gold-rimmed glasses, and with the warm hands, injected something into Alexei's good arm, with miraculous results. Within just a few minutes, the grey figures had stopped their outrageous behaviour. The mortar was moved through the curtained window onto the veranda. Its black barrel didn't seem nearly so frightening now. He could now breathe more easily, because the huge wheel had gone away, and he didn't need to clamber between the spokes any longer. The candle went out, and the angular figure of Larion, Lariosik Surzhansky from Zhytomyr, as black as coal, disappeared from the walls, while Nikolka's face became more normal and not so irritatingly obstinate, possibly because, thanks to the skill of the large man in the gold-rimmed glasses, the hands had stopped pointing so inexorably and despairingly straight downwards towards his pointed chin. The hands had now returned from indicating 5:30 to 5:20, and although the time on the clock in the dining room did not correspond to this, its hands relentlessly moving ever onwards, the senile wheezing and grumbling had nonetheless been replaced by its familiar, clear, weighty baritone, tonk. And the tower clock, just as in the magnificent toy castle of Louis XIV, chimed bom, bom, midnight. Listen. Midnight. Listen. The chimes sounded a warning note, combined with the pleasant silvery clang of halberds. The sentries walked up and down on guard, for man has unwittingly brought towers, alarm bells, and weapons into the world for one purpose only: to maintain peace among men, and to preserve hearth and home. That is the reason he goes to war, and essentially, that is the only possible reason why he should ever do so. And it was only in such peaceful circumstances that Yulia, that self-centered, depraved, but seductive woman, agreed to appear. And appear she did, in black stockings, the edge of her black, fur-lined boots illuminated briefly by the light brick of the steps, with the hasty clatter of her feet and the rustle of her dress, accompanied by the tinkling sound of little bells playing a gavotte from where Louis XIV was basking, surrounded by enchanting, exotic women, in his sky-blue garden on the shores of a lake. At midnight, Nikolka carried out some extremely important and very necessary tasks. First of all, he emerged from the kitchen with a dirty, moist rag and erased the following phrases from the side of the shipwright of Sardam. Long live Russia. Long live autocracy. Thrash Petliura. Then, with Lariosik's eager assistance, he accomplished an even more important task. From the drawer of the desk in Alyosha's room, he carefully and silently took out Alyosha's Browning, together with its two magazines and the little box of ammunition that went with it. When he checked the contents of the box, he found that 6 rounds had already been fired.
Good for him, Nikolka whispered.
It would never have entered anyone's mind, of course, that Lariosik might be a traitor. No intelligent person in general could ever, on any account, be a supporter of Petliura, and even less, in particular, a gentleman who had signed promissory notes to the value of 75,000 and who had sent telegrams containing 63 words. Both Alyosha's Browning and Nyturz's pistol were greased all over with engine oil and kerosene. Following Nikolka's example, Lariosik rolled up his sleeves, helping him with the greasing and packing everything away in a long, high-sided tin that had once contained caramels. They worked quickly, for any decent person who has taken part in a revolution knows full well that all powers that be, wishing to search people's houses, will always do so at night, between the hours of 2:30 and 6:15 in winter, and from midnight to 4:00 in summer. All the same, completion of the work was delayed thanks to Lariosik, who, wanting to acquaint himself with the workings of a 10-chambered pistol such as a Colt, placed the magazine in the wrong end. Removing it required considerable effort and a fair amount of grease. And then there was a second unexpected hitch. The tin, which was lined with paraffin paper inside and sealed with strips of sticky insulating tape on the outside, and which contained the revolvers, Nikolka's and Alexei's epaulettes, Alexei's chevron, and the photograph of Tsarevich Alexei, would not fit through the little window pane at the top, the only part of the window unsealed during the winter months. The problem was how and where to hide it. They weren't all as stupid as Vasilisa. Just that afternoon, Nikolka had hit on the idea of a possible hiding place. The wall of number 13 was right next to their neighbor's wall at number 11, with a gap of no more than a couple of feet. In number 13, there were only 3 windows on this wall, one in Nikolka's corner room, and 2 completely unnecessary ones in the library. It was dark anyway. In addition, downstairs in Vasilisa's larder, there was a dark little window covered by a grating. And the wall of number 11 was totally blank. Imagine a splendid little ravine about 2 feet in width, quite dark and invisible even from the street, and inaccessible to nearly everyone, except possibly the odd inquiring little boy. And indeed, as a boy, Nikolka had clambered into this space while playing cops and robbers, stumbling over the piles of bricks, remembering very well seeing a row of spikes running up the wall of number 13 to the roof. Before number 11 had been built, these spikes had very probably formed the support for a fire escape that had subsequently been taken down, but leaving them in place. When he had put his hand out of the window earlier that evening, Nikolka had been able to locate a spike almost immediately. All very clear and simple so far. But now the tin, tied both ways with top-quality triple cord, so-called sugarcane cord, with an already prepared loop, wouldn't go through the window. "We're clearly going to have to open the entire window," Nikolka said, climbing down from the windowsill. Acknowledging Nikolka's quick-wittedness and resourcefulness, Lariosik set about unsealing the window. The swollen frames did not want to open, and the difficult operation took up a whole 30 minutes, but finally they succeeded in opening first one window and then the second, with a long, winding crack appearing in the glass on Lariosik's side.
"Turn the light out," Nikolka ordered.
The light went out, and a blast of freezing air gushed into the room. Nikolka leant out halfway into the black, icy space and attached the upper loop of the rope to a spike. And there was the tin, hanging down perfectly well at the end of a 2-foot rope. There was no way anybody could see it from the street, firstly because the firewall of number 13 had been built at an oblique angle to the street, rather than at right angles, and secondly because there was a sign hanging high up on the wall advertising the dressmaker's business next door. You would only be able to see the tin if you climbed up into the gap. But nobody would be able to do that until the spring, because huge snowdrifts had piled up, blown in from the yard, forming an ideal barrier from the street side. But the best thing of all about it was that you didn't need to open the window to operate it. All you needed to do was to stick your arm out of the top pane, and you could pull on the rope like a piece of string. Perfect. The light was turned on again, and after softening the sealant left over by Anyuta from the autumn on the windowsill, Nikolka resealed the main window. Even if, by some strange chance, someone were to find the tin, there would be a ready-made reply. I'm sorry? Whose tin did you say? Uh-huh, revolvers. The Tsarevich? Of course not. Don't know anything about it, not a thing. How the hell should I know who put it there? They must have climbed down from the roof and hung it there. There are all kinds of people about nowadays, aren't there? Well then, we're peaceful people here. Don't know anything about any Tsarevich.
Brilliantly done, I swear to God, said Lariosik.
How could it be otherwise? The thing was accessible, and yet at the same time outside the apartment. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. Evidently they wouldn't be receiving any visitors that night. With exhausted, drooping eyelids, Yelena tiptoed into the dining room. It was Nikolka's turn to take over from her. Nikolka from 3 to 6, and then Lariosik from 6 to 9. They spoke in whispers.
So that means it's typhus, Yelena whispered. Bear in mind that Vanda has already been up to find out what's wrong with Alexei. I told her that it was possibly typhus. She almost certainly didn't believe me. She started rolling her eyes. She kept on asking how things were with us, where the others were, and whether anyone had been wounded. Not a word about the wound.
No, absolutely not, Nikolka said, waving his arms around. Vasilisa is the world's greatest coward. If it came to it, he would blurt out to all and sundry that Alexei had been wounded just to protect himself.
What a bastard, Lariosik said. That's vile behavior.
Alexei lay in his room, his mind in a complete fog. After the injection, his face had become absolutely calm, his features sharper and more refined. The soothing poison was now flowing through his blood, keeping guard over his body. The grey figures had stopped ordering everyone around as if they were in their own homes and had gone about their own business, taking the mortar away with them for good. And even if some complete stranger did appear on the scene, he would nonetheless behave respectably, trying to communicate and connect with familiar objects and people who had always been a rightful part of the Turbin household. Colonel Malyshev appeared once again, but this time he sat in a chair for a bit, smiling away as if to say everything was fine and there was nothing to worry about, rather than scowling and muttering threateningly or stuffing the room with pieces of paper. He set fire to some documents, it is true, but he didn't dare lay a finger on Alexei's diploma or the photographs of his mother, and the fire that he used was a pleasant blue-burning alcohol flame, and in any case, it was a comforting fire, because it usually preceded an injection. Madame Anjou's doorbell rang frequently.
Ring, said Alexei, trying to convey the sound of the doorbell to whoever was sitting in the chair.
They seemed to be taking turns to sit there. First it was Nikolka, then some Mongolian-looking stranger. Because of the injection, Alexei did not dare kick up a fuss. And then the melancholy, grey-haired, trembling figure of Maxim.
Ring,
the patient repeated affectionately, attempting to create a live tableau from the shifting figures in front of him. A tortuously difficult task, but one that ended in a surprisingly happy, even if painful, conclusion. The dining room clock moved rapidly on, its hands spinning round, and when the short, stubby hand approached 5 o'clock on the pale dial, Alexei fell into a semi-doze. Every so often he shifted his position, half opening his eyes and muttering incoherently to himself.
Up the stairs. Up the stairs. I'm not going to make it up the stairs. Too weak. A fall. Goodness, she's walking fast. Her boots through the snow. I'll leave footprints. Wolves. Ring, ring.